Death in Venice. Von Aschenbach has lost his wife and children to the plague. Since then, he's buried himself in his work to the point of physical and mental collapse. His doctor sends him to the Venice Spa to recuperate. The best? There he falls madly, helplessly in love, but with a boy. His passion for the impossibly beautiful youth and the impossibility of it leads to despair. The worst? When a new plague invades Venice and the child's mother hurries her son away, von Aschenbach lingers to wait for death and escape from his misery. The impact of the inciting incident creates our opportunity to reach the limits of life. It's a kind of explosion. In action genres, it may be, in fact, an explosion. In other films, as muted as a smile. But no matter how subtle or direct, out of this upheaval, you must find at climax a resolution, for better or worse, that rearranges this universe into a new order. The second of the five-part design is its progressive complications, the great sweep and body of story that spans from inciting incident to crisis climax of the last act. To complicate means to make life difficult for protagonists. To complicate progressively means to generate more and more conflict as they face greater and greater forces of antagonism, creating a succession of events that passes points of no return. When the first gap opens, the audience realizes that this is a point of no return. Minimal efforts won't work. The character can't restore the balance of life by taking lesser actions. The character must then take a more difficult action, requiring more willpower, putting him at greater risk and jeopardy. When he does, and that does not succeed in getting him what he wants, the audience realizes that even moderate actions won't get the character what he wants. When the character then must take more extreme actions, and they do not succeed in getting him what he wants, then the audience realizes even these more difficult, more extreme actions will not work. In other words, we cannot go backwards. We cannot retreat to lesser actions. We must constantly top the previous actions, in that sense, passing points of no return. The protagonist then steps out of the inciting incident and enters a world governed by the law of conflict. To wit, nothing moves forward in a story except through conflict. Writers who cannot grasp this truth, the truth of conflict, writers who have been misled by the counterfeit comforts of modern life into believing that life is easy once you know how to play the game, these writers give conflict a false inflection. The scripts they write fail for one of two reasons, either a glut of banal conflict or a lack of meaningful conflict. The former are exercises in turbo special effects, written by those who follow textbook imperatives to create conflict, but because they're disinterested in or insensitive to the honest struggles of life, devise overwrought excuses for mayhem. The latter are tedious portraits, written in reaction against conflict itself. These writers take the Pollyanna view that life would really be nice if it weren't for conflict. What writers at these extremes fail to realize is that while the quality of conflict in life changes as it shifts from level to level, the quantity of conflict is constant. When we remove conflict from one level of life, it amplifies 10 times over on another level. When, for example, we don't have to work from dawn to dark to put bread on the table, we now have time to reflect on the great conflicts within our mind and heart, or we may become aware of the terrible tyrannies and suffering in the world at large. As Jean-Paul Sartre expressed it, the essence of reality is scarcity. There isn't enough of love in the world, enough food, enough justice, enough time in life. To gain any sense of satisfaction from our existence, we must go into heady conflict with the forces of scarcity. To be alive is to be in perpetual conflict at one or all three levels of our being. To complicate a story, the writer builds conflict progressively to the end of the line. Difficult enough. But the task increases geometrically when we take story from mere complication to full complexity. Conflict may come, as we've seen, from any one, two, or all three levels of antagonism. To simply complicate a story means to place all conflict on only one of these three levels. From the horror film to action adventure to farce, action heroes face conflict only on the level of extrapersonal conflict. James Bond, for example, has no inner conflicts, nor would we mistake his contests with women as personal. They're recreational. Stories which are complicated only on the level of personal conflict are known as soap opera. An open-ended combination of domestic drama and love story in which every character in the story has an intimate relationship with every other character in the story, a multitude of family, friends, and lovers. Soap opera characters have no inner conflict nor extrapersonal conflict. They suffer when they don't get what they want, but because they're either good people or bad, they rarely face true inner dilemma. Stories that are complicated only on the level of inner conflict are not films, plays, or conventional novels. They are prose works in the stream of consciousness genre, a verbalization of the inscape of thought and feeling. To achieve complexity, on the other hand, the writer brings his characters into conflict on all three levels of life, often simultaneously. For example, the deceptively simple but complex writing of one of the most memorable events in any film for the last two decades, the French toast scene from Kramer versus Kramer. This famous scene turns on a complex of three values: self-confidence, a child's trust and esteem of his father, and domestic survival. As the scene begins, all three are at the positive charge. In the film's first moments, Kramer discovers his wife has left him and his son. He's torn with inner conflict that takes the form of doubts and fears that he's in over his head versus a male arrogance telling him that whatever women do is easy. As he opens the scene, however, he's confident. Kramer has personal conflict. His son is hysterical, afraid he'll starve without his mother to feed him. Kramer tries to calm his son, telling him not to worry, Mom will be back, but in the meantime, it'll be fun, like camping out. The child dries his eyes, trusting his father's promises. Finally, Kramer has extra personal conflict. The kitchen is an alien world, but he strolls into it as if he were a French chef. Perching his son on a stool, he asks what he wants for breakfast, and the kid says, French toast. Kramer takes a breath, pulls out a frying pan, pours in some grease, puts the pan on the stove, and turns the flame to high while he looks for the ingredients. He knows French toast involves eggs, and so he searches the refrigerator and finds some, but doesn't know in what to break them. He rummages in the cupboard and comes down with a coffee mug that reads Teddy. Little Kramer sees the handwriting on the wall and warns Kramer that he's seen his mother do this and she doesn't use a mug. Kramer tells him it'll work. He cracks the eggs. Some actually get into the mug. The rest make a gooey mess, and the child starts to cry. The grease starts to spatter in the frying pan, and Kramer panics. It doesn't occur to him to turn off the gas. Instead, it becomes a race against time. He bangs more eggs into the tumbler, rushes back to the refrigerator, grabs a quart of milk, and slaps it up and over the brim of the mug. He finds a butter knife to break up the yolks, making an even gooier mess. The kid can now see he's not going to eat this morning and cries his eyes out. The grease is now smoking in the pan. Kramer, desperate, angry, losing the fight to control his fears, grabs a slice of Wonder Bread, stares at it, and realizes it won't fit in the mug. So he folds it in half and stuffs it, coming up with a dripping handful of soggy bread, yolk, and milk, which he flings at the griddle, spattering and burning him and the kid. He snatches the pan from the stove, scalding his hand, clutches his son's arm, and pushes him through the door, saying, "We'll go to a restaurant." Kramer's male arrogance is overwhelmed by his fears, his self-confidence turning from positive to negative. He's humiliated in front of his frightened child, whose trust and esteem turns positive to negative. He's defeated by an animated kitchen as blow by blow eggs, grease, bread, milk, and pan conspire to send him stumbling out the door, turning domestic survival from positive to negative. With very little dialogue and the simple activity of a man trying to make breakfast for his son, novelist Avery Corman and screenwriter Robert Benton created one of the most memorable scenes in film, a 3-minute drama of a man in simultaneous conflict with the complexities of life. Unless it's your ambition to write in the action genres, soap opera, or stream of consciousness prose, my advice to most writers is to design relatively simple but complex stories. Relatively simple doesn't mean simplistic. It means beautifully turned and told stories restrained by these two principles. Do not proliferate characters. Do not multiply locations. Rather than hopscotching through time, space, and people, discipline yourself to a reasonably contained cast and world while you concentrate on creating a rich complexity. As a symphony unfolds in 3, 4, or more movements, so a story is told in movements called acts, the macro structure of story. A story can be told in one act, a series of scenes that shape into a few sequences that build into one major reversal, ending the story. But if so, it must be brief. In prose, this is the short story. In the theater, the one-act play. In film, the student or experimental film of perhaps 5 to 20 minutes. A story can be told in 2 acts, 2 major reversals, and it's over. But again, it must be relatively brief. The sitcom, the novella, the hour-length play, such as Strindberg's Miss Julie. But when a story reaches a certain magnitude, the feature film, an hour's TV episode, the full-length play, the novel, 3 acts is the minimum. In our effort to satisfy the audience's need, to tell stories that touch the innermost and outermost sources of life, 2 major reversals are never enough. No matter the setting or the scope of the telling, no matter how international and epic or intimate and interior, 3 major reversals are the necessary minimum for a full-length work of narrative art to reach the end of the line. The first act, the opening movement, typically consumes 25% of the telling. The Act 1 climax occurring between 20 to 30 minutes into a 120-minute film. The last act needs to be the shortest of all, a swiftly rising action to climax. If the writer tries to stretch out the last act, the pace of acceleration is almost certain to slow in mid-movement. So last acts are generally brief, 20 minutes or less. Let's say a 120-minute film places its central plot's inciting incident in the first minute, the Act 1 climax at the 30-minute point. It has an 18-minute third act and a 2-minute resolution to fade out. This rhythm creates an Act 2 that's 70 minutes long. If an otherwise well-told story bogs down, that's where it'll happen, as the writer sloshes through the swamps of the long second act. There are 2 possible solutions. Subplots that deepen the involvement of the audience and make lean the soft belly of the central plot's second act, or more acts. A film could have a Shakespearean rhythm of 5 acts, 4 weddings and a funeral, or more. Raiders of the Lost Ark is in 7 acts. The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover in 8. These films turn a major reversal every 15 or 20 minutes, decisively solving the long second act. But the 5 to 8 act design is the exception, for the cure of one problem is the cause of another. First, the multiplication of act climaxes invites clichés. Second, the multiplication of acts reduces the impact of acts and ends in repetitiousness. This is why a 3-act central plot with subplots has become a kind of standard. It fits the creative powers of most writers, provides complexity, avoids repetition, and takes us to the end of the line. If the central plot's inciting incident arrives as late as 20 or 30 minutes into the telling, then a subplot will generally be needed to hold the audience's interest while it waits for the main plot to ripen and arrive. Suppose, however, the ripe moment for the inciting incident of the central plot is reached around the 15th minute. Does a film then need a setup subplot to carry the opening? Maybe, maybe not. The inciting incident of the Wizard of Oz occurs at the 15-minute mark when a cyclone carries Dorothy to Munchkinland. There's no subplot to set this up. Rather, we're held by dramatized exposition of her longing to go somewhere over the rainbow. In Adam's Rib, the inciting incident also arrives 15 minutes into the film. As a district attorney, Adam Bonner and his defense attorney wife, Amanda, discover themselves on opposing sides of a trial. In this case, the film opens with a set-up subplot as the defendant discovers her husband's philandering and shoots him. This hooks us and carries us to the central plot's inciting incident. A subplot receives less emphasis and screen time than a central plot, but often it's the invention of a subplot that lifts a troubled screenplay to a film worth making. Witness, for example, without its love story subplot of a big city cop and an Amish widow, would be a less than compelling thriller. Multiplot films, on the other hand, never develop a central plot. Rather, they weave together a number of stories of subplot size. Between the central plot and its subplots, or between the various plot lines of a multiplot, four possible relationships come into play. First, a subplot may be used to contradict the controlling idea of the central plot and thus enrich the film with irony. Suppose you are writing a happy ending love story with the controlling idea, love triumphs because the lovers sacrifice their needs for one another. You believe in your characters, their passion, their self-sacrifice, yet you feel the story is becoming too sweet, too pat. To balance the telling, you might then create a subplot of two other characters whose love ends tragically because they betray each other out of emotional greed. This down-ending subplot contradicts the upending central plot, making the overall film's meaning more complex and ironic. Love cuts two ways. We possess it when we give it freedom, but destroy it with possessiveness. Second, subplots may be used to resonate the controlling idea of the central plot and enrich the film with variations on a theme. If a subplot expresses the same controlling idea as the main plot, but in a different, perhaps unusual way, it creates a variation that strengthens and reinforces the theme. All the many love stories in A Midsummer Night's Dream, for example, end happily, but some sweetly, some farcically, some sublimely. Third, when the central plot's inciting incident must be delayed, set-up subplots may be needed to open the storytelling. A late-arriving central plot, Rocky, Chinatown, Casablanca, leaves a story vacuum for the first 30 minutes that must be filled by subplots to engage the audience's interest and acquaint it with the protagonist and his world in order to evoke a full reaction to its inciting incident. A set-up subplot dramatizes the central plot's exposition so that it's absorbed in a fluid, indirect manner. And fourth, a subplot may be used to complicate the central plot. This fourth relationship is the most important, to use the subplot as a powerful source of antagonism. For example, in Black Widow, a federal agent becomes infatuated with the killer herself. Or in The Verdict, a courtroom drama, Frank falls in love with Laura, a spy from the opposing law firm. These subplots add dimension to characters, create comic or romantic relief from the tensions or violence of the central plot, but their primary purpose is to make life more difficult for the protagonist. The balance of emphasis between the central plot and subplot has to be carefully controlled, or the writer risks losing focus on the primary story. A set-up subplot is particularly dangerous in that it may mislead the audience as to genre. The opening love story of Rocky, for example, was carefully handled so that we knew we were heading for the sports genre. Additionally, if the protagonists of the central plot and subplot are not the same character, care must be taken not to draw too much empathy to the subplot's protagonist. Casablanca, for example, has a political drama subplot involving the fate of Victor Laszlo and a thriller subplot centered on Ugati, but both were de-emphasized to keep the emotional spotlight on the central plot's love story of Rick and Ilsa. If a subplot doesn't thematically contradict or resonate the controlling idea of the main plot, if it doesn't set up the introduction of the main plot's inciting incident or complicate the action on the main plot. If it merely runs alongside, it will split the story down the middle and destroy its effect. The audience understands the principle of aesthetic unity. It knows that every story element is there because of the relationship it strikes to every other element. This relationship, structural or thematic, holds the work together.